Hello, this is Leslie Ann Jones with a Life on Planet Porky special, as we cast our minds back 25 years to a horrific, unprecedented event that touched all our lives and still does. A quarter of a century ago today, on Sunday the 31st of August 1997, we awoke to news that Diana, Princess of Wales, had been involved in a car accident in Paris during the early hours. As the story unfolded, we learned that the princess was critically injured in the Pont de l'Alma underpass. We later heard that she had died of her injuries. Her companion, Dodi Fayed, and driver, Henri Paul, were pronounced dead at the scene. The princess's bodyguard, Trevor Rees-Jones, was the only survivor. Many of us remember exactly where we were when we heard. The mass outpouring of grief that followed was on a scale rarely witnessed before or since. The emotional reaction was a global event with floral tributes, books of condolence, and candles lit in her memory across the world. Thousands of bouquets were laid on the lawns of Kensington Palace, where Diana lived. Her funeral the following Saturday, the 6th of September, was an event of such magnitude that it was watched by an estimated 2.5 billion people. The last journey of the People's Princess, as her hearse made the two-hour ride through the streets of London to Westminster Abbey, was heartbreaking. Diana's funeral was attended by 2,000 guests, including former prime ministers, foreign dignitaries, and celebrities from the worlds of fashion, music, stage, and screen. Elton John performed an adapted version of his hit Candle in the Wind to reflect his friend's life. The single became the biggest seller of UK chart history, eclipsing Bing Crosby's White Christmas from the 1940s. Diana is remembered as a complicated woman who endured a sham marriage and gave birth to a future king. The image of her sons, William and Harry, walking along the mall behind their mother's coffin remains one of enduring sadness for many of us. Mr. Parry the Porkmeister was the first journalist to announce the news of Diana's death to the world. Today's podcast revisits that extraordinary sequence of events. Mr. Parry, sir, if I may, let me take you back to that fateful day.
Sure.
And ask you, when and how did you get the first inkling of the Diana car crash in France?
Yeah, I'll never forget it. As you quite rightly say, 25 years ago, August the 31st, 1997, and I was at home. It was a Saturday night, and I was watching Match of the Day, which everybody in those days watched on a Saturday night, you know, once you'd got home from the pub. I'd been at work all day, actually, and I'd only got in about 9 o'clock, I think, and I settled down and watched it. And then my phone rang towards the end of Match of the Day, so that must have been about, I don't know, probably 10:15, 10:30, something like that. And it was the office, and it was the chap who was looking after the night news desk. And he told me, and this is, you know, the first I'd ever heard of it, and it hadn't broken on the news tapes or anything. We didn't have, you know, great 24-hour news channels in those days like we have today. They were around, but people weren't sort of, you know, watching them round the clock like we do now, rolling news.
There was no rolling news, was there? We weren't sort of glued to it the way we can
be nowadays.
It
was very early days. Anyway. Of course, I picked up the phone. It's my home phone, not a mobile phone. And I was told that Diana, Princess of Wales, had been involved in a car crash in a tunnel in Paris. It was already known that her boyfriend, Dodi Fayed, the son of Mr. Fayed, who owned Harrods then, very wealthy billionaire businessman, had died.
So Mohammed Al-Fayed.
Mohammed Al-Fayed, absolutely right, yeah. Dodi Fayed, his son, had tragically died in the crash. And it was reported then that Diana had a broken collarbone and lacerations to her legs, which is a rather odd sort of, you know, injury sort of rundown. But that's all we knew. So that's all I needed to know. I ordered a car immediately and I the car turned up about 10 minutes later. I got in the car and I shot off back to the headquarters of the Press Association, which is, for the benefit of our listeners, which is Britain's national news agency. It's based in Victoria, in London, near Victoria Station. I was the executive editor. So to all intents and purposes, I ran the organisation on a, you know, sort of minute by minute, day by day basis. And I got back there, I think I got back there about 11:30, went up to the newsroom and then tried to start finding out what was going on, because even then, of course, it was an amazingly dramatic story. Diana's boyfriend had been killed. Diana had been badly injured in hospital in Paris. A story of enormous drama.
And who were you contacting? Did you have stringers in Paris?
Well,
did you have freelancers on the ground? What?
Well, you did all the usual things that, you know, we do in these news stories. First of all, we had to get somebody to Paris. So I don't. Fortunately, it was the early days of mobile phones. But, you know, I had a very basic mobile phone. But on the car on the way in, I was, you know, able to mobilise people, get them to the airport, get them to the ports, down to Dover and Folkestone, because we weren't sure how many flights were going to be taking off at that time of night, get on a ferry, get over to France, hire a car, get to Paris any way you can. You know, I asked people to get hold of the stringers in Paris. And then, of course, we had to mobilise the team that look after Royal Stories. We had a very, very good Royal editor who was very well connected to the royal family, because the Press Association, being the national news agency, was often the conduit for releases from the royal family, you know, because it's neutral, because it doesn't have any, you know, political bias, and it doesn't have any what's the word, attitude towards royalty, pro or anti. The Press Association was always the channel through which royal announcements were made. So, you know, we knew exactly where to go. The problem was, even though we were very well connected there, there was absolutely no information coming back. Now, the other avenue, obviously, was the avenue of politics, because Tony Blair had not been in power for very long. But he, you know, won a landslide victory. He was, you know, a supremely sort of good communicator. And so it was obvious that in some way he was going to be involved in probably pronouncing to the country, you know, the details of this terrible incident. So we had a very strong political team also at the Press Association, probably about 10 or 12 people who worked in the Houses of Parliament. So every one of those was immediately, you know, trying to get to their own political contacts to find out what was going on.
You were very fortunate, I think, to have your diplomatic correspondent with Foreign Secretary Robin Cook in Manila, but you couldn't find him.
Well, honestly, you couldn't have had a luckier break. I mean, you don't get lucky breaks when you're covering such tragic stories, but the information had to be put together. We had to start finding out what was going on. And my diplomatic, I think his title was diplomatic and security editor. He looked after the diplomatic side of, you know, overseas affairs and that kind of stuff. He was also defence correspondent, and he was with Robin Cook somewhere in the sort of Philippines type area when Robin Cook was the foreign secretary under Tony Blair. Now, when you go on these tours with the foreign secretary or the prime minister, you can do something like 3 or 4 different locations a day. You know, you're visiting different capitals, different countries, and you land, and sometimes you don't get further than the airport. You know, there's a meeting between the foreign secretary, our foreign secretary, and their foreign secretary, which might take place in a hotel on the edge of the airport, and that might last an hour, and then you're back on the plane, and you're off again to another country. So it was the early days, as I said, of mobile phones. So it was very difficult to, you know, to try and find out where. Now, my diplomatic and defence editor, I think his name was Charlie Miller. And I really chide myself for not remembering fully. He was a great guy, a great operator, and his name was certainly Charlie. So we'll call him Charlie from now on. And eventually through, you know, a series of eliminating where he wasn't, we found that Charlie was in Manila, and managed to get a call through to some airport desk or something like that. And miraculously, About an hour later, the phones were ringing, of course, off the hook, because so many people were getting involved in the story in different angles and different ways. And phone rang, and suddenly somebody shouted over, "Mike, it's Charlie." I thought, great. So I got hold of Charlie, and it wasn't a great line, but I explained to him what had happened. Now, he didn't even know that the accident had taken place, because A, it had only happened, you know, an hour or two before. B, he'd been in an aeroplane anyway. And so I was telling him something he didn't know. And like everybody else who suddenly found out, he was terribly shocked. But I said, the thing is, Charlie, as I understand it, because I'd try to find out how people in this country get informed when members of the royal family are overseas and something happens, I found out that it actually happens between foreign secretary to foreign secretary. It doesn't happen from head of state to head of state or prime minister to president or whatever. It goes through the channels of the Foreign Office. That's international diplomacy. So I said, you're with Robin Cook, go back to his people, because Robin Cook was in a meeting somewhere, and see if you can find out what's going on. What Charlie said to me was that he'd first become alerted to the fact that something was going on, but he had no idea what it was until I explained to him over the phone. When they were on the aircraft and it was about to take off, and it had left the apron going towards the runway, but then suddenly turned around and went back to the apron, and everybody got off again. So clearly something was going on. And then Robin Cook went into a room, into a meeting with people, and I told Charlie to go and find out where the meeting was and see if he could, you know, get amongst Robin Cook's people. So Charlie came back to me about half an hour later. He said, it's clearly something very serious. You know, everybody's talking in hushed tones and people looking quite sallow, you know, quite shocked and white-faced. And I said, that's amazing. You know, it's obviously a huge international story, huge international incident already. But the one thing we needed to know, because we couldn't find out from anywhere else, was just exactly what the condition of Diana was. You know, we obviously tried everybody in France, the hospitals. By this time, we had people outside the hospital in France, people that we'd, you know, what we call stringers in Paris, had gone to the hospital along with like hundreds, if not thousands, of other journalists and camera crews and everybody outside the hospital to try and find out what was going on. Anyway, off Charlie went. So by this time, we're trying people in America, because the Americans have very good connections, obviously, internationally, diplomatically and all that. We're trying members of Diana's family. I can't remember whether Diana's mother was still alive. I think she was, and she lived up in Scotland. And, you know, we were trying to track her down, although she may not have known either, because so little information had come out. But anyway, we're trying to put pieces of the jigsaw together, and the corridors of power in Whitehall, deafening silence about what was going on. We were out at Buckingham Palace, at Kensington Palace, and it was simply, I don't know, it's just a, well, you know, it's a hackneyed old expression, but a wall of silence. So we had to keep trying to find out what was going on. Anyway, about half an hour later, Charlie came back to me again. So I suppose now it's probably about 2 o'clock in the morning or something like that. And he said that he couldn't get a definitive answer to the question, how badly injured, please, is Diana? You know, we really need to know. And again, it was the old wall of silence, and we're not at liberty to discuss the issue and all this kind of stuff. You've got to remember that, you know, people have to be informed. And of course we understood that, you know, the family and British government, all that kind of stuff. But nevertheless, I just got the feeling that there must be something going on here, because surely the world wanted reassuring. Do you see what I mean, yes, Leanne? You know, what we wanted to be able to do was to be able to say, whew, okay, folks, thank goodness, you know, we've established that, you know, though Dodi Fayed has died in this tragic accident, we can at least tell you that, you know, Diana is well, that she has got a broken collarbone or something like that. She is being treated in hospital, getting the finest medical treatment. But none of that was coming forth at all. None of it at all.
Did you, in your heart of hearts, did you suspect the worst? Did you fear the worst?
You know, when you first told about a story, you and I being journalists, you always get some image in your head of how this is going to unfold. And the minute I was told, and while I was waiting for my car at home to take me back into the office, I had an image in my head of Diana in a wheelchair, right? Because, you know, I'd been told she'd broken her collarbone. So I had an image in my head of Diana in a wheelchair and with her arm in a sling. Do you see what I mean? You know, to support her broken collarbone and perhaps, you know, like a sort of bandaged leg or something like that, because I'd been told about the collarbone and lacerations to her leg. So that's the image I saw. I thought that's going to be the next time we see Diana. We'll be wheeled out of the hospital in a wheelchair, probably in a couple of days' time. But then as the night wore on, increasingly it became clear to me that my judgment was nobody was saying anything, because what they had to say was too terrible. And that feeling was growing on me all the time. You know, I thought, I just don't understand why. I mean, Tony Blair in particular, right? So although the lines of communication were from Foreign Secretary to Foreign Secretary, so Robin Cook was being briefed by the Foreign Secretary of France, even though he was in Manila doing it on a telephone line, obviously. Nevertheless, Robin Cook then had a duty, obviously, to report to Tony Blair, the Prime Minister. And we all know that Tony Blair does not, you know, hide under a bush, does he? You know, when Tony Blair, you know, thinks the world needs to know something, he always wants to be the person to tell them. And quite rightly, he's the Prime Minister, leader of the country, and therefore you would have expected that the information should probably come from him. But we couldn't get anywhere politically, you know, as I say, our political people were very good. Some of them were actually able to contact Tony Blair personally. I don't know whether they did that night, because you remember it's now sort of 2:30 in the morning. But it was that deafening silence that I couldn't get over. So I started sort of, you know, casting around and trying to see what we had to put the pieces of the jigsaw together. And everything in my mind gave me the conclusion that this was even more terrible than we'd imagined to start off with. Anyway.
And how many pieces of that jigsaw did you have to put together to convince yourself that you were right before you released this earth-shattering news that she died? Mm.
Well, every piece of the jigsaw was blank. Do you see what I mean? Because I couldn't get any information on anything. We'd done things like obviously rung medical experts and said, you know, to what extent is a broken collarbone serious and how could laceration on the legs happen, all that kind of stuff. What we did have, which again added to my, you know, growing dread, was we had some reports then coming back from the scene of the crime, the scene of the crash. And, you know, the reports were that it was an utterly devastating car smash. The car had smashed into a concrete pillar in a tunnel at a very high speed. But for the first kind of 10 or 15 minutes, people were able to stand by the wreckage. Now, you know, there's been a debate for the last 25 years about to what extent did the paparazzi have a role in the death of Diana, Princess of Wales. You know, that's a totally different story. I mean, Diana and the media had a very complicated relationship. But wherever she went in the world, she was followed by photographers, and there were photographers standing by the vehicle. And so there were images. And to this day, there are images of Diana in the back of that vehicle, actually dying, I'm afraid to have to say, which will never be published. But the thing was,
have you seen them?
No, I haven't. No, I don't know who has. I don't know anybody who has seen them. But what I'm saying is that information was filtering back, obviously. So again, I'm thinking, and the other thing was that she wasn't taken out of the vehicle for, well, a good, I think it was about 10 or 12 minutes or something like that, and taken off to the hospital. But then from then on, you know, the thing I couldn't get out of my head was, whenever an incident like this happens, you always get a medical report from the hospital, because the whole thing you've got to stop is wild speculation. You know, if there's a, you know, when John F. Kennedy was shot, and when, well, even his brother, you know, Robert Kennedy was shot and all that, the medical report is so important because it affects the whole of the world. Now, I know you might say, well, Diana, you know, wasn't influential in the affairs of the world, in the balance between East and West, you know, the stock market and all that. Nevertheless, she was the most famous woman in the world, and she was, you know, to many people, one of the most powerful women in the world, because her popularity was so great, she could influence people to do something. So, again, I couldn't figure out why we weren't getting a feedback from the hospital, a medical report. You'd have thought at some stage that just to stop the, you know, the huge number of journalists who'd now crowded around the front of the hospital and, you know, obviously trying to get in to find out what was going on, somebody should have come out, a medical director or something like that, and said, you know, right, I'll give you a holding statement or something like that. That wasn't coming. And so as the, you know, the clock kept turning to 3 o'clock, 3:15, I managed to get Charlie back again, right? And I said, look, Charlie, I think what we're going to have to do is, I think we're going to have to be quite brutal about this in our approach with Robin Cook's people. And I think you're going to have to go back to him again, and you are going to have to put to the Foreign Secretary that the worst possible thing could have happened in that tunnel in France tonight, and that as the Foreign Secretary really has a duty to let the British people know, and we're the press association, and if there's going to be an announcement, it needs to be done through us. So Charlie went off and found Mr. Cook personally, because the previous couple of times he'd just spoken to his people. Now, I don't know, and, you know, Charlie may well be listening to this, so he's the only person who knows. I don't know what Charlie actually said to Mr. Cook, and I don't know what Mr. Cook's response was. All I know is, and you know the way journalism works, you either trust your people or you don't. Charlie came back on and he said, Mike, he said, I think Diana is dead. I said, right, now can you imagine being told that at, you know, sort of 3:30 in the morning, or about 3:45, I think it was. And I said, okay. Now, you know, and I know, Leslie-Ann, that if your boss then says to you, are you absolutely sure, can I trust you, then, you know, you're on a bit of a sticky wicket, because your instincts either tell you that the person you're talking to is a first-class journalist who wouldn't possibly have said that to me unless he was absolutely convinced. So I don't know whether he put the question directly to Mr. Cook. I don't know whether Mr. Cook responded, or whether it was, you know, I couldn't possibly comment or something like that. Whatever it was, Charlie was certain that Diana had expired in that tunnel. And then I had to make my mind up what I did with that information. By now it was after 4 o'clock.
This is Leslie-Ann Jones for Life on Planet Porky. We are talking about Diana, Princess of Wales, her tragic death 25 years ago today on the 31st of August, 1997. And Mike Parry, the Porkmeister, is reliving his experiences of breaking that story of her tragic death to the world. Mike, did you have any resistance from your own staff on the Press Association news floor, who perhaps wouldn't go with you on your instincts to release the story?
Well, that's a very good question, Leslie-Ann. And I immediately then thought, what a responsibility this is, OK? Because I've just found out that Diana, Princess of Wales, has died. I was the only person in the whole of the world who knew that. In your intro to this podcast, you told our audience that 2.5 billion people around the world watched Diana's funeral. Now, that's just an indication of how popular she was, how well known she was, and how the world was fascinated by her every move. Now, I held a piece of information then which because of my job as executive editor of the Press Association, I had an obligation to release to the world. But there were one or two things that I had to still think about. So working at a news organization like that is a technical thing. When you're putting information out, you're sending it out on computers and that sort of thing. I didn't know how to work the computers. I was a journalist. I wasn't a technician. And, you know, we had all the great technicians in the newsroom who distributed the information that the journalists brought in. So I said to Ongai, I said, look, we're going to have to release the news to the world that Dinah has died. And this particular chap said, but we haven't got any official confirmation of it. I said, no, we haven't got official confirmation of it, but I happen to believe it's true. And I'm running the Press Association at the moment, so I'm going to put it out. It's my responsibility. I have to believe my people. I certainly believe Charlie when he told me what he's told me. He's a first-class journalist, and he wouldn't possibly have said that to me, because you can't play games with such sensitive information. And therefore, I'm going to put it out. Anyway, the first chap I spoke to said, I don't really want to press the button with that information going out. And I said, that's fair enough. I said, I completely accept that you're probably thinking, what if it's not accurate? What if it's not true? And I can understand you thinking that because, you know, you can't read my mind, but my mind is absolutely certain of what I'm doing. So I then turned to a second chap. And I said, look, I'm going to dictate to you a line. And I'm trying to find that line here. I've got the original document here. And I want you to type this out, please. And I want you to then put it out. So he said, OK. So I dictated the line. And the line was, newsflash. That's the highest level of alert, you know, for a breaking news story. And I dictated it to him off the top of my head. And I said, Diana, Princess of Wales, has died, comma, according to British sources, the Press Association learned this morning. So he typed that out on his screen. So I went over and looked at it. And I read it again. And the whole thing said, Royal Diana, PA Newsflash, Diana, Princess of Wales, has died, comma, according to British sources, the Press Association learned this morning. And the time on the bottom was 31 August 97, 4:41 a.m. And we looked at each other, and I thought, one more time, and I thought, you've got to have self-belief. You've got to believe in yourself. Do you believe Charlie? You've done everything you possibly can. We spent 4.5 hours trying to find out what's going on in a wall of silence. And then I said to the chap who was sitting there, I said, right, let it go. It went. And the reaction around the world was incredible. You know, our phone started ringing off the hook immediately. We were getting other news broadcasters were picking it up. Now, there was one live TV station at the time. I don't think it was even British, because we had a, you know, bank of screens, obviously, in the newsroom. But the floor manager ran across a camera onto the floor. Do you see what I mean? He ran across the side of a camera with his headphones on and said, PA are saying she's dead. And then, like, major debate started all over the place. She can't be, and all this kind of stuff. And I was accused of gross irresponsibility. And, you know, there's no official announcement. What are Downing Street saying? What are the Palace saying? What are the French saying? Nobody was saying anything. So,
apart from Mike Parry, can I ask, did you clear the story with your own bosses before the release?
Well, that's a very good question, because to explain, the Press Association has to be believed at all times, because it is the national news agency of the United Kingdom and Ireland, actually. And therefore, the greatest pride they put in their business is that everything is accurate and right. And had this been wrong, it would have been the end of my career. but it would have very, very badly have dented the reputation of the Press Association, which had been going for about 150 years, by the way. It would have smashed their reputation forever. And, you know, you had to think about that when you were doing this. There was no way back at all. So my immediate boss was the editor-in-chief of the Press Association. His name was Paul Potts, a great guy, a terrific journalist, and an insider, because before he'd got to the lofty heights of being the editor-in-chief of the Press Association, he'd been a political journalist in Whitehall, in the corridors of power. So he knew a lot of people, right? And he could have gone to it. But my problem was, I knew that if I'd have rung him and got him out of bed at 4:30 in the morning to tell him that, in my opinion, Diana had died in a car crash in France, he would immediately have said, have we got the official confirmation? And then I would I'd have to be absolutely honest with him and say, no, there is no official confirmation yet. And then he'd say, well, we can't put it out. We're the Press Association. And I would have then had a debate with him. I know he would have said this because he had a responsibility to make sure that the Press Association's reputation was never damaged, and he couldn't possibly have taken the risk. He hadn't spoken to Charlie in the way I had. He hadn't picked up in Charlie's voice, you know, the depth of emotion and the shock and the horror that Charlie's voice represented to me, which made me believe that everything Charlie had told me was absolutely true. So I had to make that judgment on my own without being able to refer to anybody else, because nobody else knew. So, you know, with no disrespect to Mr. Potts at all, I knew he would have had to say to me, we can't put it out till we get an official confirmation. Now, that would have meant I wouldn't have put it out, because if I had done then, I'd have lost my job anyway, even though it was true. If I'd have disobeyed that instruction, I would have gone. So I couldn't risk that either. So I was determined to put the information out because I knew it and I had the information. I had to share it with the world, but I think I would have been prevented doing that had I rung my boss. Now, that was obviously a pretty tense and stressful moment. It was 4:30 in the morning. It was August. It was quite a balmy evening. Windows were open and all that kind of stuff. And I'd suddenly notified the world that the most famous woman in the world had perished in a car crash. So,
what was it like, you know, in that 17 minutes between you putting out the PA newsflash and the actual official announcement? You'd taken a massive leap of faith. You must have been quaking in your boots, heart in your mouth. What was it like for you during that quarter of an hour?
Well, to be honest, I wasn't, because I was so convinced I was right, I wasn't even considering being wrong. But you're absolutely right. I thought, look, once I've put this out, then the authorities will have to react, because, you know, through whatever means, the information has now gone public. Diana has sadly, very, very sadly, perished in the car crash in the tunnel. So they'll have to respond. So I expected, you're absolutely right, I expected an immediate response from Downing Street, from the Foreign Office, from the French authorities, from the hospital, from the royal family, but it didn't come. I thought it would happen within 2 or 3 minutes. And, of course, all the people around me were just as – and I'm not laughing at such a serious situation. I'm thinking now of the just total silence across a newsroom full of about 40 people, because, you know, it's one of those moments when nobody knew what was going to happen next. So, obviously, I felt like the spotlight was very much on me. And I even said to the chap who'd put it out, I said, look, you mustn't worry about anything. It's totally my responsibility. I gave you an instruction. You picked up on it. That's your job. I was doing mine. You were doing yours. You mustn't worry about anything. And then, of course, 10 minutes went by and I thought, I don't know what's going on here. And we were getting calls from all over the world then. We were getting calls from America and New Zealand, Australia and everywhere, all wanting to speak to the person who put out that release. And I utterly refused to speak to anybody personally because what was I going to tell them? And they would have said, how do you know? How did you find out? Well, I wasn't going to tell anybody that, because as you well know, that's not the way journalism works, you know? So I had to allow the rush that I'd put out speak for itself. Now, it was exactly 17 minutes when all of a sudden pictures started sort of flickering in from France. I'm just finding what we put out next. Hang on. Tell you in a second. And a chap called Mr. Chevènement, right, who is the French Foreign Secretary, came out of the Élysée Palace. So this wasn't the hospital that Diana was in. This was the Élysée Palace, which you know better than me. You've probably been there a few times, Leslie-Anne, haven't you?
I have, yes. Yeah. I lived in Paris for 2 years.
Yeah, well, you know the Élysée Palace. It's the most famous building in Paris. Well, not most famous, it's the Eiffel Tower. But anyway, and he came out and he stood at a microphone and he read out a statement. I think he did it in French and English, but I certainly got the English version. And he confirmed the rush that I'd put out 17 minutes earlier that, very sadly, Diana, Princess of Wales, had died in a car crash in that tunnel in Paris earlier that night. So that meant that I had contrasting emotions, one of doom and gloom and terrible, terrible sadness. You know, Diana had been a part of our lives for years as Diana, Princess of Wales, and, you know, everywhere she went, she was photographed. There's a story about Diana in the papers every day, and I mean every day. You know that as well as I do. I spent time chasing around the Caribbean when I was working in New York for the Daily Express. We used to go and hire boats down in the Caribbean and follow her around. I'd done jobs. I mean, in fact, funny enough, one of the first jobs I ever did when I got on the Daily Express in Manchester was go to North Wales to see Charles and Di on their first tour of the Principality after they got married. And, excuse me. And I remember then that I was amazed at the incredible interest she provoked amongst people just in the streets. You know, there were thousands of people queued up overnight to see the royal car drive past and all that kind of stuff. And in fact, funnily enough, it was after that mini tour of North Wales that Charles first became aware of the enormous worldwide interest that his wife generated wherever she went. And again, I'm not laughing. Prince Charles, from that moment on, I believe, having spoken to royal experts ever since, he started to resent her popularity in comparison with his. You know, she was seen as this beautiful, gorgeous young princess, married to her prince. He was seen as a bit of a stuffy old guy. He was 12 years older, I think, wasn't he? 12 years old.
12 or 13, yeah. Oh,
that's right. Then
he was dreadfully resentful of her. Yeah, that was the beginning of the end, I think.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And so, you know, and honestly, enormous sadness hit me when I realised that I'd got it right, she was dead, but that I was the one who'd informed the world about her demise. Enormous sadness came over me, really. I mean, not tears, but I just sat down in stark silence. You know what I mean? It was an unbelievable development. It was easily the biggest story that I'd done in my life. It was the biggest story for everybody involved in it and will remain the biggest story for many people to this day. The other emotion, of course, I had was of tremendous relief that I'd got it right, and tremendous pride in Charlie at having been bold enough to definitively tell me that he was sure that Diana was dead, pride that I believed him, and then pride in the organisation, the Press Association, and the people around me who supported my decision to put it out.
Was the crash an accident?
The crash was definitely an accident. I mean, here on the 25th anniversary, all the conspiracy theories have come up again, and they are conspiracy theories. Diana was followed by photographers everywhere. That night was wild and panicky because She was supposed to come out the front door of the hotel, but she came out the back door and the drivers were switched. And I think the guy was called Henri Paul, the driver. Okay. He was over the limit, drinks wise. The inquest later into Diana's death didn't actually specify that he was drunk when he was driving the car, but it said that death came about as a result of his reckless driving. But the official investigation in Paris quite clearly stated that he was way over the acceptable drink drive limit when he was driving that car and it crashed into a pillar. I mean, honestly, I saw a program just this week, another program about, it was called Diana, Death in Paris. And, you know, once again, all the conspiracy theories were aired. You know, people were flashing lights in his face to try and stop him. Well, the car was doing about 120 miles an hour when it crashed. We know that from the investigation into the, you know, the mechanical condition of the car afterwards.
Oh, and the state of the car when they brought it back to the UK. I could not believe how concertinaed and smashed up it was.
No, absolutely. You know, nobody could have overtaken the car, flashing lights in the driver's face, all that kind of stuff, all a load of nonsense. And another story that's emerged this week is Diana foresaw her own death. You know, she told her lawyer she was going to die in a car crash and wrote it down on a piece of paper. But the most tragic element of the car crash, as everybody now knows, yourself included, Leslie-Ann, is that she didn't have a seatbelt on. She was sitting in the back of the car with Dodie. They didn't have the seatbelts on. And actually, what killed her was the compound injury on her chest. You know, she was thrown forward into the seat in front, in which the bodyguard was sitting. I think his name's Trevor Rees-Jones. And he had his seatbelt on. And he didn't die, but Diana did from the crush injury of hitting the back of the of his seat, actually. And, you know, the whole thing was just an utter tragedy. But no, honestly, the other thing is, and, you know, you don't really want to start, you know, raising questions about Diana and her behaviour, but Diana had a very close relationship with the media. You know, people said, oh, she was hounded. And honestly, Diana fought her battle against the royal family largely through the pages of newspapers and interviews and that kind of thing, because that's all she had. You know, she didn't have an official spokesperson. The royal family is a huge machine with incredible ability to communicate to the world and all that. And she felt sometimes the only way she could get her point of view over was to, you know, to talk to journalists. And she had some very trusted colleagues. One of them you and I know very well, Richard Kay, who was the, you know, the royal correspondent at the Mail on the Time. He's still a, you know, great award-winning journalist. And so the hounding thing, I won't accept. I mean, I was a tabloid journalist like yourself, and I was there for about 25 years. And, you know, we didn't like hounding people because the press aren't widely liked anyway. So you tried to do things as diplomatically and as politely and as, you know, harmlessly as you possibly can. And hounding wasn't one of them. There was quite a good understanding with Diana. That was that, you know, if she was anywhere, you got one picture and then you left her alone. The problem that night was, A, she was in Paris, so you were dealing with continental paparazzi, and I'm not being critical of my colleagues overseas, excuse me, but they are a lot livelier than the photographers we have in this country, you know, Italian and French and all that kind of stuff, right? So they were, you know, they were perhaps more enthusiastic than it would have happened in London. But the other thing is, because she was out of the royal family, she didn't have official protection. She didn't have official guards. The guards were provided by Mr. Al-Fayed's family, and that's not a criticism. What I'm saying is that had she still been a member of the royal family, she would have obviously had all the same safeguards and protection and diplomacy around her that the royal family get. But she left the royal family. She, you know, divorced Charles, and for that reason, she was a private individual who had to try and provide her own protection and her own safety. And many say that's one of the reasons why she was drawn to Dodie Fayed, because his father was a very rich and powerful man and could provide that sort of protection, both with bodyguards, with safe locations, and with, you know, the wherewithal to keep her at arm's length from, you know, the rest of the world, because everybody wanted a bit of Diana.
What do we take away from this tragedy? Does the royal family have any blood on its hands?
No, I don't think so, honestly. I don't think anybody's got blood on their hands. The, you know, the driver was drunk. That was established in the inquiry. He crashed the car trying to... I don't know how close people were behind him, like paparazzi and all that, but he said as he got into the car something to the effect of, you won't catch me, you know what I mean? So he was determined to get away. He was in the wrong frame of mind, in my view. And it was nothing more than a very, very tragic accident. You could say nothing more. It was obviously, you know, a horrendous incident and all that. But nowhere in anything that I've ever seen since will convince me that there was a plot to try and take Diana's life. That, to me, is just ridiculous. I want Diana to be remembered for what she was. And I honestly want to conclude this piece by saying, Diana, please rest in peace.
Mr. Parry, thank you.